Welcome back to Lungcast, the monthly respiratory health podcast series from the American Lung Association and medical news site HCP Live. I'm your host, Dr. Albert Rizzo, the Chief Medical Officer of the American Lung Association. Before we introduce our guest today, just a reminder that Lungcast is available on all your favorite streaming platforms. You can subscribe to @Lungcast on YouTube to get new and archived episodes, as well as interview segments and episode highlights as they come out. A link to the show page, as well as the ALA and HCP Live homepages for Lungcast, can be found in each episode description. And for those of you who prefer a podcast, you can subscribe to Lungcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and your favorite listening platforms. You can also register for more respiratory news and insights at both lung.org and hcplive.com. Heat is an important environmental and occupational health hazard. To many, heat stress is the leading cause of weather-related deaths and can exacerbate underlying illnesses, including cardiovascular diseases, diabetes, mental health, asthma. It can increase the risk of accidents and transmission of some infectious diseases. The occurrence of heat stroke is a medical emergency with a high case fatality rate. The recording of this podcast is occurring during July of 2024, in which the heat extremes across the country are record-setting. This has prompted the increased recognition of more people who are suffering from serious burns from contact with hot outdoor surfaces on the pavement and concrete. For some, the burns are so extensive they prove fatal, according to many burn experts. The number of people exposed to extreme heat is growing exponentially due to climate change in all world regions. Heat-related mortality for people over 65 years of age has increased by approximately 85% between 2000 and 2004, and the most recently checked 2017 to 2021. Between 2000 and 2019, studies have shown approximately 500,000 heat-related deaths occur each year. Now, to give us some perspective on this important topic, our guest today is Janelle Bluedorn, physician assistant and assistant professor of family medicine and community health family medicine and community health at Duke University, who has extensive experience in emergency medicine. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you so much, Dr. Rizzo. I am personally very excited to join you today on Lungcast to talk about heat-related health impacts with you and your listeners. And I do want to kind of start off to say, and this is something that I say whenever I talk about this topic, and that's no matter who you are or what you do, I really hope that you find some value in the conversation that we're going to have right now. And so for any clinicians that are listening, I really hope that this conversation elevates the awareness that you must know how to identify and manage individuals with heat-related illness, and also be able to provide solid patient education on prevention. And for anybody else that's listening, I really, really hope that this conversation can help inform you to keep yourself and your family members safe and healthy as we all live in this hotter than ever world.
Now, before we talk more about respiratory consequences of extreme heat, based on your position, could you please give us an overview of heat-related illnesses in general that often present to the emergency rooms like where you work?
Yeah, absolutely. And as you alluded to in your introduction, heat-related illness is on the rise. In fact, extreme heat is going to be our number one weather-related cause of death in the United States. And what I'm going to say next is kind of interesting. And it actually kills more people most years on average than hurricanes, floods, and tornadoes combined. However, research shows that when you compare with thinking about events like storm surges and wildfires, the general population tends to feel more uncertain about the threat of extreme heat, and they don't really perceive as much personal risk. And so this creates kind of this mismatch between the reality of the danger, as well as the actions that people actually take to protect themselves. And this can be dangerous. And this is what, you know, winds people up in the emergency department. And it also is what leads to that increasing mortality rate that you had alluded to due to heat-related illness. We've actually, over the last 20-ish years, seen kind of like this ebb and flow in data from the National Center for Health Statistics when it comes to mortality rates for heat-related illness. But since about 2020 or 2022, we've actually seen a pretty sharp increase in the amount of heat-related mortality. And a lot of this comes from that kind of like mismatch between, you know, the perceived risk and the actual risk with hotter temperatures. In the emergency department, we kind of think of three big heat-related conditions, kind of from this emergency medicine standpoint. And these are heat stroke, heat exhaustion, and heat cramps. And heat stroke out of those three has the highest mortality rate. Actually, there's about a 20 to 60% mortality rate for that condition. It's quite high. And that's going to be characterized by high body temperature. There's going to be altered mental status, and eventually multi-organ failure occurs. Heat exhaustion, on the other hand, is on the same spectrum. It's just less severe. There's high body temperature. People's mental status is still intact. And there's a lot of times going to be dehydration occurring concurrently. And then milder than those two is heat cramps. And these are pretty painful muscle spasms that occur after physical exertion in the heat. And this is going to be due to dehydration, so fluid losses, but then also electrolyte losses, namely loss of like sodium and potassium due to sweating. And of course, there's other heat-related illnesses. You know, off the top of my head, I'm thinking about some of the emerging trends that we're seeing with like kidney disease in outdoor agricultural workers in the heat. Of course, relevant to this podcast, you know, the effect that heat can have on exacerbation of chronic respiratory conditions. But the big three systemic conditions that we think about in emergency medicine are heat stroke, heat exhaustion, and heat cramps. I am a medical educator, and so primarily a medical educator. So a lot of times my students hear me say, or I'll kind of fall back on the phrase, that everything in medicine is really just applied physiology. And I don't really want to bore your listeners with a huge physiology lecture here. But I do think it's important, especially as we get into some of the other parts of our conversation, I think it's important for people to understand what thermoregulation is and also what acclimatization is. So I'm just going to go over those two briefly here. So thermoregulation is basically how we as humans maintain our body temperature in this pretty narrow range of about 97 to 99 degrees Fahrenheit. And our bodies do this by balancing environmental heat loads, so like how hot it is outside, with heat dissipation, or how we get that out of our body. Inside of our brains, the hypothalamus runs this show basically, and it causes our body to do things like vasodilation and sweating to promote evaporative cooling. It also bumps up our pulse, or increases our pulse and our respiratory rate, and that's because we have increased oxygen consumption due to the heat. And so thermoregulation works quite well in most people, but it tends to be impaired in the really, really young, as well as the very old, so in our pediatric and our geriatric populations. Acclimatization is the other physiology term that I'll briefly go over here. And this is when the body makes some physiologic adaptations as a result of being exposed to a hot environment over and over again or repeatedly. These changes make the body better at being able to tolerate the heat. It basically makes the body a much more efficient machine to be able to tolerate the heat. And it takes about a week or two of kind of consistent exposure for acclimatization to occur. And I make mention of this, and that's because heat-related illness, especially ones with higher mortality rates, tends to happen more commonly when a body is not able to go through that acclimatization process for whatever reason.
Very good. That's great information and review of the physiology. Always helpful. And I think using that, I've heard you speak before, and I think one of the techniques you talk about is how to assess or screen individuals for their risk of heat-related consequences. Tell me more about that.
Yeah, so my background's in emergency medicine. And so I feel like in the emergency department, I would be doing risk assessment sort of after the fact. Basically, somebody would present to the emergency department with a heat-related condition. We'd identify it, manage it, and then we'd talk about how to avoid it in the future. So kind of like secondary prevention, if we want to use like, you know, kind of blanket medicine terms here. But I think that there's a really huge opportunity for primary prevention, or preventing it before it actually has that first occurrence, both via primary care clinicians as well as through public health messaging. And I think that there is a, or I know that there's this article that came out in 2022 in the New England Journal of Medicine, by Sorensen and colleagues, and it was called Treatment and Prevention of Heat-Related Illness. And I bring this up because it covers screening and prevention for heat-related illness really quite well. And what they say in this, or what they recommend in this, is that clinicians should for everybody before the hot season begins where they live. Clinicians should be screening all patients for their risk of heat-related illness and then be able to identify heat-vulnerable individuals. And so they can do this in a couple of different ways, or there's a couple different steps to do this. And this is something that I do talk about when I speak nationally and locally on this topic. And so this includes looking at individual factors in the patients to understand their susceptibility. And so understanding what's the patient's age, as we've already covered, young mm-hmm. patients and older patients tend not to be able to fare as well in the heat. Whether that patient or individual has any coexisting conditions, especially lung or kidney conditions, if they're pregnant, if they use certain medications or drugs that maybe may make them more susceptible to heat-related illness for whatever reason, whether they have like cognitive impairments or disabilities, whether they have social isolation or have immobility where they're not able to move themselves out of a hot environment if they do recognize that it is actually hot. So after that, when screening individuals for their risk of heat-related illness, it's important to make note of the individual's heat exposure risks. And so this includes the ambient temperature as well as the humidity in the geographic location where that individual lives. Mm-hmm. I'm in North Carolina. Probably the heat exposure risk where I live is going to be greater than somebody that, say, lives in the Pacific Northwest of the United States. Mm-hmm. Also looking at heat amplification. And so we know that there are things called urban heat islands. And so in urban areas where there's a lot more pavement or concrete, less green space, individuals that live in those areas are going to have higher risk of heat exposure. Also considering occupation. Is your patient an indoor worker that doesn't have access to cooling? Are they stuck in like, checking in a toll booth or something like that where there's not like air conditioning? Or are they outdoor agricultural worker where they don't necessarily have the access to, hydration adequately? Whether these people have access to cooling at home or if there's any like indoor heat sources that might be running inappropriately during the summertime. And then after you take into account mm-hmm. those things, you should also think about some of the socio-cultural factors that an individual may have when it comes to their risk. This includes things like their socioeconomic status. People who live in poverty are going to be at higher risk because they may not have the access to cool spaces, air conditioning, even hydration or shade. Thinking about environmental racism or structural racism, social cohesion, somebody's housing status. If they're unhomed, obviously they're not going to have as readily accessible access to like air conditioning, literacy, as well as limited worker protections. And that last one, limited worker protections, that's going to vary state by state. There are some states that do have limited, that have worker protections for people that work outside in the heat. And there's some states that very specifically actually do not allow for those types of protections for workers. And so being cognizant of what kind of that socio-cultural or socio-political environment is where you're practicing or where you're living is going to be important. I think that also just kind of once you've risk stratified people into whether they're higher risk to be vulnerable for heat-related illness, is just making sure that individuals as well as their family members, their caregivers are aware of that vulnerability status before the warm season even begins, because that's going to help empower individuals to be able to take necessary precautions to manage their well-being during periods of elevated temperatures. And so this could mean things like ensuring that people understand key signs and symptoms like excessive sweating or even the cessation of sweating. Those are going to be key signs and symptoms when you're exposed to heat, to extreme heat. Also thinking about providing information to people in terms of when they should seek cooling or like things like being able to turn on a fan or turn on air conditioning or, find a public place nearby that has air conditioning. Having power outage plans, and then also if you are a clinician listening here, considering bringing in your interprofessional colleagues like social work or people like case managers who know about community resources to help patients meet their needs. And we may talk about this later too, for people who are at higher risk than the general population, so folks that may be athletes or outdoor mm-hmm. workers, outdoor agricultural workers, construction workers, those types of things, there may be additional counseling for prevention that needs to take place for those folks. And so thinking about frequent breaks for hydration, the clothes that you wear, ensuring that they're breathable or light colored, and then covering or any like potentially exposed areas to protect it from the sun. So like hats, sunscreen, and then avoiding the midday for training or work if that's at all possible.
That was some great advice in general. I'd like to switch a little bit and begin talking about the respiratory system. You know, weather conditions, particularly temperature, can contribute to the development as well as the instability of several respiratory diseases. Understanding the relationship between temperature and respiratory diseases is crucial, particularly given the increasing frequency and intensity of extreme temperatures that are being caused by climate change. As noted by the World Health Organization, an individual's vulnerability to heat is shaped by physiologic factors, some of which you already talked about, the age, health status, underlying conditions, and exposure factors, such as occupation, socioeconomic conditions. All the social determinants of health can play a role. Published in the American Journal of Respiratory and Critical Care Medicine back in 2013, a 10-year study of Medicare respiratory hospitalizations and outdoor heat in 213 U.S. counties was reviewed, and it was found that the risk of respiratory hospitalization significantly increased with daily outdoor heat. And this relationship persisted across age categories, sexes, county climates, and could not be explained simply by changing concentrations of air pollution alone, which is certainly one of the concerns the American Lung Association has. So you may have touched on this already, but can you talk a little bit more about your experience dealing with respiratory consequences of extreme heat?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the two biggest players in this instance are going to be COPD or chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, as well as asthma. Mm-hmm. So we've seen both anecdotally just on shift in the emergency department, but also statistically in the medical literature that exacerbations of these chronic conditions do significantly increase in hot weather. I mean, you just cited a couple studies here that basically said just that. But why is that? Well, in hotter and more humid weather, the body needs to use additional energy to regulate the temperature. This goes back to that idea of thermoregulation that I talked at the beginning here. And so that's going to bring along some physiologic changes. It's going to increase that respiratory rate. There's going to be increased metabolic demand and oxygen demand. So basically, the body has to work harder just to maintain normal. So the body's already under some stress. Then when that hot air is breathed in, hot air can actually irritate the airways and cause some inflammation and induce some coughing. Plus, the airways themselves might even be drier than usual due to maybe some relative or actual dehydration due to like sweating losses of fluid. And that dryness in both the upper and the lower airways can lead to the symptom of shortness of breath and kind of start like this cycle of exacerbation. And I know you've already mentioned it a little bit, and it's not completely going to explain the increased rates of the exacerbation, but during extremely high temperatures, air outdoors tends to become stagnant. And so it does trap pollutants or particulate matter. So, you know, combination of solid particles or liquid droplets in the air. So things like dust and soot or smoke from wildfires, pollens, various pollutants. Those are particulate matter. And so those in that stagnant air just get kind of trapped. And those high levels of particulate matter are known to drive up heat-related respiratory condition exacerbations. And so higher rates of COPD exacerbations, higher rates of asthma exacerbations. And so as an emergency clinician in dealing with this, I have two pieces of advice. Number one is have awareness of the weather conditions and the air conditions in the community in which you are working. So knowing that you may anticipate to see more asthma or more COPD exacerbations as temps go up, or if you're somebody who has asthma or COPD, know that you may have a lower threshold to end yourself up in an exacerbation state. Number two, the second thing I recommend from an ER standpoint is that when patients come in the hot weather with the COPD or asthma exacerbations, and they will come in, the data backs that up, do what you're trained to do. Just swiftly identify, swiftly stabilize, and then manage using evidence-based medicine.
In preparing for this discussion, came across a topic that was a little under the radar screen from my background. And that has to do with understanding how some of the common medications that our patients are on can sometimes be affected by the extreme heat and how that medication is occurring in that patient. So can you comment a little bit on that?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like we're probably only going to be able to scratch the surface because there are just so many medication considerations when it comes to heat. And I guess for the sake of simplicity or to kind of create a little bit of organization around this, I kind of mentally like to put these issues into two categories. The first category is medications that make the body more vulnerable in the heat. Mm-hmm. And then the second category is medications that pose like logistical challenges to the heat. And so for that first category, things that increase vulnerability, we actually want to think about both prescription medications as well as over-the-counter medications that can impair the way that a body is able to tolerate heat or regulate its temperature, because we know that that can predispose people to actual heat-related illness. And so, as we've already went over, sweating is a very important part of thermoregulation. It's what allows evaporative cooling to happen. But some medications actually decrease the ability for somebody to sweat, making it harder for them to cool down. So that includes things like antihistamines. Diphenhydramine is going to be an example of that. Some mental health medications like amitriptyline, and even some like blood pressure medications like clonidine can decrease the ability for somebody to sweat. I want to make note of another blood pressure medication or a class of medications, beta blockers. And so metoprolol, as well as some decongestants like pseudoephedrine. Those medications actually don't allow for as much vasodilation or doesn't allow for the blood vessels to kind of expand to their size. And this vasodilation is really important for thermoregulation. And so if somebody's on beta blockers or some classes of decongestants, it also can make it hard for them to keep cool. There's other meds that can cause imbalances in electrolytes and the fluid status, as well as lead to some dehydration, which is not going to be beneficial in hot weather. So this includes some diuretics that might be used for high blood pressure, or maybe even like laxatives that might be used for GI symptoms. When somebody is dehydrated, they can have decreased blood flow to their kidneys. And so that can actually lead to kidney injury in the heat, especially if they take over-the-counter non-steroidal anti-inflammatory medications or NSAIDs like ibuprofen. Also, dehydration can make the relative concentration of some medications higher in the bloodstream, making them super therapeutic or being above the therapeutic range. And that can actually lead to some adverse effects. There's also some medications that can actually directly increase an individual's body temperature. So we think about stimulant medications, and so like methylphenidate, which is used for ADHD or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Other antipsychotic medications used for mental health conditions can also raise the body temps. And a very common medication people are on, levothyroxine, which can be used for hypothyroidism or an underactive thyroid. That can also directly increase the body's temperature. And I know we're not really talking about like skin effects of the heat or the sun, but commonly we hear about like doxycycline, an antibiotic, or like topical retinoids. They lower the threshold for people to have redness of their skin due to UV exposure or sunburn. But there's actually some other surprising medications that do the same thing. So, for example, a very common diuretic, furosemide or Lasix, that actually can do the same thing and make people more susceptible to sunburn. So that was that first category of medications that kind of like make you more susceptible to heat. Did anything surprise you before we go to our second
category?
No,
that's great. Great comprehensive study there.
Yeah. So that second category is meds that kind of pose logistical challenges when it's hot outside. And when we think about this, you have to understand that, and you understand, but everyone should understand that appropriate storage of medications on hot days especially is going to be important, because heat exposure can compromise medications or the delivery devices that they use to get those medications into a human's body properly. One example that I believe that you're aware of is that in temperatures above 120 degrees Fahrenheit, which, I mean, My car's parked in an outdoor lot right now in Durham, North Carolina. I'm sure the inside of my car is greater than 120 degrees right now. But metered dose inhalers, or MDIs, those can actually burst when they get above 120 degrees Fahrenheit. EpiPens, these may malfunction or maybe even deliver not the right amount of epinephrine when they're exposed to heat. Insulin used for diabetes. This should be stored in a refrigerator. The vial should be stored in a refrigerator if it's an unopened vial, and then it should be stored at a room temperature if it's opened. It actually may become less effective and lose its strength if it's left in the heat. So if it's like not in the refrigerator when it's closed, or once it's open, if it's in very high temperatures. And on the note of refrigeration, it's not specifically about a medication, but we should think about things like rolling blackouts. These are occurrences that can happen due to increased energy demands on electrical grids during heat waves. So individuals who have medications who require refrigeration, or maybe medications that require electricity, like somebody who uses a nebulizer that needs to be plugged into like an electric source, or maybe even people who have medical devices like a CPAP for sleep apnea, or maybe they have like an LVAD, for significant cardiac disease that has to be charged. People who rely on electricity for their medications or their medical devices really do need to be mindful and plan ahead for a backup plan in case of heat-related rolling blackouts.
Absolutely. Now, I wanted to go back a little bit to your important topic of prevention and preparing the patients. I understand the National Weather Service provides a heat risk indicator, which is a color numeric-based index that uses high-resolution weather, climate, and Centers for Disease Control and Prevention information to identify potentially dangerous heat. Now, have you found this helpful for your patients? Could you please give us a summary as to why it's helpful?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the most helpful thing about this particular tool is that it is intuitive to understand. It is not complex. It is very approachable. Without even reading any accompanying words, you don't have to even read the text. Somebody could look at the color coding of this tool, especially as it overlays on a map, and they could say, yikes, we're in the red today. I better plan ahead for the heat. Or, they may say, where I live is just shaded in green. It's not going to be so bad. So that, in my opinion, really, really makes for a good public-facing risk assessment tool. It's so intuitive. I'll briefly just kind of go over what this is for people who may not be familiar with it. So it's the National Weather Service heat risk tool, and it is a color numeric-based index that identifies and then also conveys very intuitively potentially dangerous heat during a 24-hour period, and it actually provides a forecast for the coming 7 days. And so the things that it takes into account in order to kind of come up with this like risk stratified color warning system is, number one, how unusual the heat is for the time of the year. So like 90 degree day in July might not be as unusual as like a 90 degree day in February. It also takes into effect duration of the heat. And very importantly, this includes whether or not there's a respite from the heat overnight, or do the overnight temps remain quite high. And then it also just infuses in some historic CDC data on heat-related impacts. And taking those three data points, it stratifies the risk into five color-coded categories: green, yellow, orange, red, and magenta. And in each of these categories conveys what population groups are most at risk, how common that heat is, and what actions can be taken and by whom, and what kind of impacts might be expected in that geographic location. And so those five categories, I'm not going to go through each of them, but like they range from green, which is classified as little to no risk from expected heat. And it goes all the way up to this kind of like ominous magenta color. It looks scary. It looks like a scary, ominous magenta color. And that signifies extreme risk. And basically what that means is that there's a level of heat that is rare for that location or that time of year. There's little to no overnight relief, and it affects anyone without effective cooling or without adequate hydration. And It gives a heads up to like healthcare systems or heat sensitive industries that they should expect impact. So they should expect more patients to come into their health systems due to the heat, or they should expect disruptions in their industry if it's like an industry that is heat sensitive. I think that relevant, especially for the LungCast podcast, is there is guidance that the CDC does give when it comes to people, especially children with asthma, as it relates to this tool. And that's because most average people are more the usual person can tolerate up to a heat risk of orange when you're kind of looking at those color coding. However, many people with asthma, especially children, will actually need to take action at a lower level. So when it's at that yellow level, is what the CDC says. And so that means like when you're in that yellow level of heat risk, folks, especially younger people with asthma, may need to stay indoors or a cool environment, ensuring that their medications have proper storage and a storage plan, staying hydrated, and then monitoring for symptoms and seeking care if needed. I don't know if I necessarily want to go into this next idea that I have so much, but I'll make mention of it here.
Sure.
What we talked about right now, this National Weather Service heat risk tool is just one tool to convey heat risk. There is another one that is gaining kind of public recognition after years of really just kind of been used by the military in some industries. And this is the idea of the wet bulb globe temperature. So this is a measure of environmental heat as it affects a human's body. And it takes into effect the air temp, the humidity, radiant heat, and so like the heat that's coming from sun or other sources, as well as air movement or if the air is stagnant. So thinking about wind and ventilation. It's not as intuitive, but I do suspect that we will probably be seeing more of this in the future and maybe having this type of measurement start to be integrated into or replacing some of these other ones that we see more commonly.
And are these indexes fairly readily available on apps or websites?
I actually love, I mean, I have no endorsements and no endorsements and no conflict of interest here. But yeah, like the Apple Weather and everything integrates these things in quite well. The CDC does have a link on their website directly to that National Weather Service heat risk tool. I've never accessed it directly from the National Weather Service website at all, but I do know that it does link to from the CDC. So yes, these are readily accessible, either integrated into, your apps on your phones or on well-known and reputable websites.
Right. Yeah, I kind of liken it to the airnow.gov quality air index,
Yes,
which we're very
absolutely.
familiar with the lung disease patients. Very good. That's a great review of those indices. My next question, I think we've covered a lot of it, but I'll let you expound on it more. It has really to do with what are some more of the recommendations for once you've identified your patients, particularly those with the lung disease at risk, are there other recommendations you can make with regard to their activities, the clothing? I think you talked about this a bit, but I'll let you kind of summarize again what you think are good advice to give to patients.
Yeah, I think that we can kind of just bullet point these points. And so the first would be staying indoors. And if you are indoors, ensuring that there is some sort of like cooling mechanism or ventilation mechanism. So air conditioning is best, but if that's not possible, fans or air movement, ensuring that you're checking weather updates. And so this includes a lot of those indices that we mentioned. Heat index, the wet bulb globe temperature, the National Weather Service risk tool, but then also like air quality indices, especially for people who have lung disease. Planning your day, being intentional about your day. If you're able to kind of shift when you're outdoors, out and about doing things to the morning or to the evening, so avoiding that midday of like 10 a.m. To 3 p.m., that would be ideal. For people who smoke tobacco, consider quitting that because that's going to impact your overall lung fu function. And then while we're talking about substances, cutting back on alcohol use when it's hot outside because alcohol can also dehydrate you, which makes it harder for you to adequately keep your body cool. We talked a bit about clothing, but in general, loose and light colored clothing are going to be helpful. in order to keep a body cool, and as well as keeping sun-exposed areas covered with things like caps, or even sunscreen. If you're able to avoid straining yourself to conserve energy so your body doesn't have to work a lot harder just to maintain its appropriate body temperature. So trying to avoid strenuous exercises during hot weather, making sure that you stay hydrated by drinking plenty of water. And water doesn't just have to be, drinking water out of your big Stanley water cup or something like that. A lot of foods can also include, have high water content. And so we think about melons, cucumbers, a lot of our fruits, and vegetables. So you can consume water and hydration, not just by drinking water. And then just doing things to keep your body cool. So, using a cool shower at the end of the day if you're starting to feel overheated. Like I said, like covering sun-exposed areas if possible with like a cap or even like a sun umbrella. And then the last part is just making sure that you have a plan for health emergencies, especially in the heat. And so ensuring that you have medications that you may need for quick relief, that may be an inhaler, that may be other medications if you have are experiencing breathing problems. And then also knowing where you would go if your symptoms or your clinical state was becoming too much for you to manage. And so where is the emergency department? Where's the urgent care nearest to you?
Great, great, great advice. Another topic I wanted your perspective on in the news lately because of the summer heat, there's been a lot of talk about FEMA and the fact that FEMA has not routinely used extreme heat emergencies as something that they would consider a FEMA-related system. So, what's your perspective on that? And do you think there's some evidence that this may become something FEMA becomes more aware of?
I mean, I'm not intimately aware of everything that FEMA does. I mean, when I think of FEMA, I think of floods and flooding, as well as, after tornadoes and hurricanes. I guess like my initial thoughts on this, having not yet, really well informed myself, is follow the data. The data does not lie. I kicked off this episode sharing the facts that heat-related illness actually causes more morbidity and more mortality most years in the United States than any of our other natural disasters combined. Those are some pretty hard facts right there. And so, I am not intimately aware of the funding structures or what, constitutes or how you would go about changing in the bureaucracy of our government, how you would go about changing, what would allow or trigger FEMA to make this change. But I think if you look at the statistics, if you look at the data, I think it would definitely be a worthwhile change to include extreme heat along with a lot of the other natural disasters that FEMA already does provide wonderful support for.
Well, you've given us a lot of great discussion and a lot of comprehensive reviews on many of these topics around heat-related issues. So I want to thank you for your time today and your willingness to share your expertise with our listeners. So to our listeners, if you want to hear more regarding all things respiratory related, we've developed a great archive of discussions on our show feeds. Be sure again to subscribe and rate Lungcast on your preferred listening or watching platform, and visit lung.org and hcplive.com for more news and resources. So until next time, I'm Dr. Albert Rizzo reminding you that if you can't breathe, nothing else matters.